I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you are sitting down with your family or friends on a Friday night to play a high-stakes game of Monopoly.
Okay, I can picture that.
You've got your favorite token, the board is all set up, the money is distributed, and you are totally ready to build this massive real estate empire.
Right, the classic weekend scenario.
Exactly. So you roll the dice, you land on Boardwalk, scrape together every single dollar you have, and you buy it.
A very aggressive opening move, but I like it.
Hey, you gotta play to win, right? You are planning to build a hotel on your very next turn, but before the dice even make it all the way around the table, the player who's acting as the banker clears their throat.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, they announce that, well, actually, starting this turn, hotels on dark blue properties are illegal, and on top of that, you actually owe a special retroactive tax just for holding the deed.
Oh, wow. People would absolutely flip the table over that.
Right, you'd be furious. And I mean, if on the very next turn the rules changed again, you wouldn't invest in anything.
No, of course not. You'd hoard your cash, stop trading, or yeah, literally just flip the board and walk away.
Because it completely destroys the incentive structure.
Exactly. Strategy becomes totally impossible if the basic laws of physics in your universe are being rewritten every few minutes.
Yeah.
You're no longer playing a game of skill at that point. You're just, trying to survive random events.
Which is honestly the perfect entry point for what we are exploring today on the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to uncover the hidden economic price of political instability.
It's a huge topic.
It really is. We are pulling back the curtain on how unpredictability actually alters market behavior, how it shifts global supply chains, and ultimately drains your wallet.
And we have some fascinating data to back this up.
We do. We are drawing from this incredibly comprehensive historical and economic dossier. It analyzes the really turbulent window between 2015 and 2029, specifically chapter 14 of this material.
It was a wild 14 years, economically speaking.
To put it mildly. But before we dive in, I want to make something super clear to you, the listener. We are looking at this purely through an analytical lens.
Yes, that's a very important distinction to make right up front.
We are going to be discussing heavy polarization, bruising trade wars, and massive legislative shifts. But we're looking at them strictly as economic variables.
We aren't taking sides.
Exactly. Just like a meteorologist tracking a hurricane, we are here to read the financial weather report and analyze the fallout. We are absolutely not here to argue about the political ideologies that created the storm in the first place.
And that framing is essential, I think, because the fundamental thesis of the data we are looking at is that economics and politics are not separate spheres.
Right, they are totally linked.
Completely linked. We often talk about them as if the market is this pristine, independent ecosystem and politics is just like noise in the background.
Yeah, you hear that a lot on financial news channels.
You do. But every single capital allocation decision, whether a family is taking out a 30-year mortgage or a multinational corporation, is breaking ground on a $20 billion semiconductor fab. It relies on an assumption about the future.
And stability generates trust.
Precisely. Stability generates trust, and instability forces markets to price in massive risk premiums.
Well, let's start with that concept of trust because the analysis introduces a really fascinating framework right out of the gate.
The invisible capital concept.
Yes. It argues that America's greatest historical economic advantage wasn't its geographic isolation or its massive consumer market or even the dollar status as the reserve currency.
Which is what you usually learn in Econ 101.
Right. But the sources say the ultimate superpower was something they call invisible capital.
Yeah, and the best way to think about invisible capital is it's like the operating system running in the background of your computer.
Okay, I like that analogy.
You don't interact with the operating system directly most of the time, right? You interact with your applications, your banks, your retail stores, your stock portfolios.
You just expect the operating system to work.
Exactly. But if that operating system is buggy or prone to crashing, none of those applications function correctly.
So, what exactly makes up this economic operating system?
The data breaks this down into four specific pillars of trust that constituted this invisible capital. First, it's the absolute assumption that contracts will be honored.
Right. You sign a deal, it means something.
Second is the reliability and independence of institutions, meaning courts, central banks, and regulatory bodies operate on their mandate, not on a political whim.
Makes sense.
Third is the predictability of legislation. And fourth is the rigorous protection of property rights.
I really want to focus on that third pillar, the predictability of legislation, because when we look at that 2015 to 2029 window, that seems to be where the operating system really started throwing error codes.
Oh, absolutely. The blue screen of death was flickering quite a bit.
Yeah. And nowhere is that friction more obvious than when we look at the national debt during that period.
The debt trajectory during those 14 years is just a prime case study in what happens when political gridlock meets mathematical reality.
We saw the national debt compound at a rate that, honestly, it fundamentally altered the federal balance sheet.
It did. But, you know, the sheer size of the number isn't actually the most interesting part of the analysis. It's the structural shift in why the money was being borrowed.
Right, because running a deficit isn't inherently new. Governments have always borrowed money.
They have. But historically, massive deficit spending was a cyclical emergency lever.
Like breaking the glass in case of fire.
Exactly. A government would run a staggering deficit to finance a global war, like World War II, or to inject life support into the economy during a severe depression.
And the idea was always that it was temporary, right?
Right. The implicit social contract was that once the crisis passed, the spending would retract. And the economic growth generated by peacetime would gradually stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio.
But that's not what happened here.
No. What shifted leading into and throughout the 2015 to 2029 period was that deficits became a permanent structural feature of the state.
So let's unpack the mechanisms driving that structural shift. Because we aren't just talking about a few pet projects or earmarks here. We are talking about massive, immovable financial obligations.
Huge obligations. The data points to a confluence of five major drivers. First, you had sweeping tax cuts that fundamentally reduced the revenue baseline.
So less money coming in right off the bat.
Exactly. Second, relentlessly rising healthcare costs, which consume just an enormous percentage of federal outlays.
Medicare and Medicaid are massive.
Huge. Third, you have consistent increases in baseline defense spending. Fourth, the massive economic stimulus programs.
Right, most notably the multi-trillion dollar injections during the pandemic.
Yes, but also subsequent industrial subsidies, which we'll get into later. And fifth, the one that acts as a compounding feedback loop, the mounting interest payments on the debt itself.
Because when interest rates go up, the cost of carrying that debt explodes.
Exactly.
And underlying almost all of the mandatory spending is this huge demographic time bomb.
The aging population.
Yeah. You have this aging population shifting out of the prime tax-paying demographic, and they are moving into the demographic that draws heavily on social safety nets and federal healthcare programs.
It's simple math. You have a shrinking base funding an expanding pool of liabilities.
Combine that demographic reality with a hardened political consensus that, you know, raising broad-based taxes is basically electoral suicide, and you have a structural deficit.
The gap between revenue and outlays is no longer tied to an emergency. It is hard-coded into the system.
Okay, let me challenge this narrative a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because we hear this doom and gloom about the debt constantly, right? Like, all the time.
Sure, it's a very common talking point.
But the sky didn't fall. If we look at the late 2010s and early 2020s, despite these massive structural deficits, the stock market was hitting all-time highs.
It was booming.
Capital was flowing freely. Mm. So if the debt was such a catastrophic erosion of this invisible capital, why were investors pouring trillions of dollars into U.S. equities? It seems like Wall Street completely ignored the structural deficit you're talking about. I mean, if a regular person maxes out their credit cards, the bank cuts them off. Why does the government get a pass?
That is a really vital distinction to make. And it comes down to understanding the difference between short-term asset price inflation and long-term sovereign trust.
Okay, break that down for me.
So the stock market hitting all-time highs during that period was heavily driven by liquidity. Those massive stimulus programs and tax cuts we just mentioned, they put an enormous amount of capital directly into corporate balance sheets and consumer pockets.
And companies use that capital for stock buybacks, right?
Exactly. Which mechanically drives up equity prices.
So the market was euphoric precisely because of the deficit spending. The government was essentially subsidizing the stock market's growth.
In a sense, yes. But here is where the invisible capital comes in. Investors purchasing U.S. Treasury bonds, the people actually lending the government this money, they operate on a very different time horizon.
The bond market is a whole different beast.
Totally. The global financial system relies on the U.S. Treasury being the ultimate risk-free asset. The market doesn't panic over the absolute height of the debt stack. A $20 trillion, $30 trillion, or even $40 trillion debt can be managed.
As long as what?
As long as the market implicitly trusts that the U.S. government possesses both the economic capacity and, crucially, the political willingness to service that debt.
And that willingness is the key word, which brings us perfectly to the debt ceiling crisis.
Oh, yes, the debt ceiling.
Because if the bedrock of the global economy is the assumption that the U.S. will always pay its bills, turning the authorization to pay those bills into a hostage negotiation seems like a catastrophic, unforced error.
It really is. It is the economic equivalent of playing Russian roulette with the global financial system.
Wow, Russian roulette. Strong way to put it.
But it's accurate. The debt ceiling, as a legal mechanism, is highly unusual. In most democracies, if a parliament passes a budget, the authorization to borrow the funds to pay for that budget is just automatic.
You decided to buy it, so you automatically agree to pay for it.
Right. But in the U.S., the authorization to borrow is a completely separate legal cap. And during the 2015 to 2029 window, because those deficits were structural like we talked about, that ceiling had to be raised repeatedly.
But instead of a routine clerical vote, it became weaponized. We saw these incredibly dramatic standoffs where the Treasury would have to take, you know, extraordinary measures just to keep the lights on.
Shuffling money around between federal retirement accounts just to pay bondholders.
Yeah, and we would get within days, sometimes literally hours, of a technical default. Now, the analysis notes that actual default was avoided every single time. So I have to ask, did this political theater actually cost us anything, or was it just a media spectacle?
Oh, the cost was very, very real.
Yeah.
And it materialized in risk premiums.
Risk premiums.
Yeah. Even without an actual default, the mere threat of one forces institutional investors, central banks, and money market funds to prepare for the worst-case scenario.
Right. They can't just hope for the best.
Exactly. If you are a pension fund manager in Tokyo holding billions in short-term U.S. debt, and you see American politicians openly debating whether they should just allow a default, you have to hedge that risk.
So how do you hedge it? What do you actually do?
You demand a higher yield. You go to the U.S. Treasury and you say, look, if I'm going to hold this paper through the X date, the day you might run out of cash, I need a higher interest rate to compensate me for the risk that my payment might be delayed.
And the data shows this actually happened.
Yes. The yields on Treasury bills maturing right around those critical standoff dates spiked significantly. That is millions, sometimes billions of dollars in extra interest payments funded by the taxpayer, simply to compensate investors for political dysfunction.
That's wild. Just throwing money away because of a political staring contest?
And furthermore, it led to credit rating downgrades. It signaled to the world that the reliability of institutions, pillar number two of our invisible capital, was fracturing.
It's kind of like having a pristine credit score, right? But you keep calling your mortgage lender every single month and screaming that you might just burn the house down instead of paying them.
That is a perfect analogy.
Eventually, they are going to hike your rate, regardless of your actual income.
Exactly. That tension fundamentally reshapes how capital flows. And while we are talking about these massive macro-level forces like sovereign debt and global bond markets, the analysis makes a sharp pivot here to how this instability acts as a hidden tax on the micro level.
It trickles down to consumer purchasing power and corporate supply chains very quickly.
Very quickly.
Right. And the most aggressive, tangible hidden tax we saw during this era was the massive resurgence of inflation following the pandemic.
A huge shock to the system.
We had an entire generation of consumers and business operators who had literally never experienced persistent high inflation. They were used to this 2% baseline where prices barely moved year to year.
We're taken for granted.
And suddenly we're looking at 8%, 9% inflation. The analysis points to a collision of factors creating this.
The inflation spike was a textbook example of complex systems failing simultaneously. First, we had severe supply chain disruptions.
Factories offline, ports totally gridlocked.
Right. Critical components like semiconductors were just unavailable. That severely constricted the supply of goods. Simultaneously, we had surging energy prices, which were exacerbated by geopolitical conflicts.
Which raises the cost of producing and transporting almost everything.
Exactly. And then on the demand side, you had governments and central banks pumping historic amounts of liquidity into the system to prevent a pandemic depression.
So you had central banks keeping interest rates near zero, just flooding the zone with cheap credit, while legislatures were sending direct stimulus payments to citizens and businesses.
Yes, it was a violent friction between monetary and fiscal policy. So you have a tightly constrained supply of goods, meeting a massive, artificially boosted surge in demand. prices just had to gap up.
It's basic supply and demand on steroids. And we understand the mechanical economic pain of that, right? It hollows out savings. It crushes wage growth.
It's a highly regressive tax.
But the analysis we were reviewing draws a deeper psychological line here. It argues that inflation is one of the most potent destroyers of political trust.
Yeah, it really is.
Why is the political fallout from inflation so much more severe than, say, the fallout from a stock market correction?
Because it is totally inescapable, and it strips individuals of their agency.
Okay, unpack that a bit.
Think about it. If the stock market drops 20%, that hurts investors, sure. But a large portion of the population doesn't track daily equities. They might not even have a 401k.
Right, but everyone buys groceries.
Everyone buys groceries. Everyone pays for housing and energy. When a citizen goes to the supermarket and the basic arithmetic of their survival changes week to week, when a gallon of milk or a tank of gas suddenly requires a larger percentage of their labor to acquire it, induces this profound sense of helplessness.
They feel like the social contract has been breached.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
The implicit agreement in a modern fiat economy is that the state will manage the currency responsibly. When the currency rapidly loses value, citizens literally feel that their labor is being stolen from them.
And that fuels anger.
Huge amounts of anger. The analysis points out that economic anxiety of this nature almost immediately mutates into political rage. People demand immediate solutions to complex global supply-side problems. Mm-hmm. And when those solutions don't materialize fast enough, they lose faith in the institutions entirely.
So inflation accelerates polarization because it creates a high-stress environment where zero-sum thinking dominates.
Exactly. It's a vicious cycle.
Which feeds perfectly into the next major variable the data tracks, severe political polarization as an economic headwind.
This is where it gets really interesting for businesses.
I want to look at this from the perspective of a corporate boardroom, because we often think of corporate America as somewhat immune to the culture wars or the political squabbling in Washington, right?
Right. The idea that business is business.
Yeah, as long as the tax rates are favorable, they just keep churning out products. But the data from 2015 to 2029 suggests that polarization became a massive operational liability.
It became an inescapable factor in risk modeling for these companies. The analysis details how deeply divided societies create this massive whiplash effect in policy.
Oh, whiplash.
Yeah. If control of the legislative or executive branch changes hands every 2 to 4 years, and each new administration views the previous administration's framework not as, you know, something to tweak, but as an existential threat to be completely dismantled, the regulatory environment becomes completely erratic.
Okay, walk me through a concrete example of how that whiplash actually changes a real-world business decision.
Consider the energy sector. Let's say a company wants to invest in a major infrastructure project, say, a network of natural gas export terminals, or conversely, a massive offshore wind farm.
Okay.
These are multi-billion dollar investments with decades-long lifespans. They require securing land rights, environmental permits, specialized labor, and a really complex long-term financing.
Yeah, you can't exactly build an offshore wind farm over a long weekend. It takes, what, 10 years just to get the permits sometimes?
Precisely. Now imagine you are the CEO evaluating that capital expenditure. Under one political regime, your project is heavily subsidized, it's fast-tracked for permitting, and it's hailed as the future of American energy.
So you dive in.
Right. You spend hundreds of millions on preliminary engineering and site prep.
Yeah.
But 2 years later, the political winds shift. The new administration is fundamentally opposed to your specific energy source.
Oh, no.
Suddenly, your permits are stalled in endless administrative review, your subsidies are threatened with repeal, and the EPA is drafting new regulations specifically targeting your operations.
You are completely stranded. You've committed massive capital, but the rules of the game changed halfway through the build.
And the result of witnessing that happen to your peers is that capital expenditure just paralyzes across the board. The analysis refers to this as the wait-and-see premium.
The wait-and-see premium.
Yeah. Businesses look at the polarization, they realize that no policy is durable beyond the next election cycle, and they simply hold off. They delay breaking ground. They hoard cash.
Or they opt for those short-term stock buybacks we discussed earlier.
Exactly. Rather than making long-term investments in research, development, or physical infrastructure because the regulatory horizon is just completely opaque.
Okay, I see the logic there, but let me play devil's advocate again.
Go for it.
You mentioned businesses shifting to stock buybacks. Many companies actually posted record profits during this era. They learned to navigate the polarization, they hired the right lobbyists, they managed their PR, and they made a lot of money. Doesn't that suggest that businesses are actually incredibly resilient to political drama?
Resilient, yes, but at what cost to the broader economy's future? You have to distinguish between maximizing short-term quarterly profits and driving long-term economic expansion.
Meaning they're just squeezing the current assets?
Exactly. A company can optimize its current operations to squeeze out record margins without investing a single dollar in the future.
Yeah.
But if an entire economy does that for a decade, if every major corporation delays building the next generation of factories or funding deep R&D because the political landscape is too volatile, you are effectively eating your seed corn.
You look incredibly wealthy right up until the moment your infrastructure collapses or a foreign competitor just out-innovates you.
That's it, exactly.
It's like skipping the oil change on your car to save a few bucks. Your monthly budget looks great for a while, but eventually the engine seizes.
And the repair bill is catastrophic.
And when we talk about foreign competitors, we have to look at the other massive variable from this era, trade wars. The 2015 to 2029 period saw the dismantling of the free trade consensus that had basically governed the global economy for 40 years.
The shift regarding global trade, specifically the escalating tensions between the United States and China, fundamentally rewired the global supply chain.
It was a massive pivot.
It was. For decades, the dominant corporate strategy was just-in-time manufacturing. It was heavily reliant on ultra-efficient, highly concentrated supply chains, largely based in Asia. The entire goal was to minimize inventory and maximize cost efficiency.
Keep the warehouses empty and let the ships arrive exactly when you need the parts.
Right. But then the tariffs hit. And it wasn't just a handful of tariffs on steel or aluminum. It escalated into a sweeping restructuring of how the two largest economies in the world interact.
The analysis meticulously documents how these trade tensions manifested. We saw broad import tariffs, which act as a direct consumption tax on domestic buyers.
We saw aggressive export controls, too.
Right, particularly regarding advanced technology and intellectual property, effectively severing tech companies from really lucrative foreign markets. We also saw foreign direct investment heavily scrutinized or blocked entirely on national security grounds.
So if I'm a manufacturer relying on a critical component from Shenzhen, my cost of goods sold just spiked overnight due to a tariff that I had absolutely no control over.
So how did supply chains actually react to that? Did companies just eat the cost, or did they fundamentally alter their operations?
Well, initially, many tried to absorb the cost or pass it on to consumers, hoping the tariffs were just a temporary negotiating tactic.
Just a bluff.
Yeah, a bluff. But as the realization set in that this was a permanent geopolitical realignment, a structural change in that invisible capital, we keep coming back to, the strategy shifted to de-risking, or what they call China plus one.
China plus one, meaning what?
Companies began the agonizingly slow and expensive process of duplicating their supply chains.
Meaning they keep their Chinese factories to serve the Asian market, but they have to build an entirely new redundant factory in Vietnam or Mexico or the U.S. just to serve the American market without getting hit by tariffs.
Yes. They physically moved production lines. They engaged in nearshoring, bringing manufacturing to Mexico or Canada, or reshoring back to the United States.
That sounds incredibly expensive.
It is. Building redundant supply chains destroys the efficiency that made those companies highly profitable in the first place. You are spending billions of dollars not to create a better product, but simply to mitigate geopolitical risk.
The analysis highlights that political decision-making became the central, unavoidable factor in basic corporate strategy.
It wasn't just about making the best widget anymore. It was about navigating the geopolitical minefield to get the widget to the customer.
Which sets the stage perfectly for the massive pivot we saw in government behavior during this time. While businesses were scrambling to build these defensive, redundant supply chains, governments realized they could no longer just sit back and let the free market dictate where critical goods were produced.
Right. The era of laissez-faire was over.
This era marked the dramatic return of industrial policy.
This is one of the most significant macroeconomic reversals detailed in the entire data set. From roughly the 1980s until 2015, the prevailing Western economic orthodoxy was neoliberalism.
The idea that governments should set basic, light-touch rules, lower trade barriers, and let the invisible hand of the market allocate capital to its most efficient use globally.
Exactly. If it was cheaper to build microchips in Taiwan and pharmaceuticals in India, the market dictated that's where they should be built. End of story.
But the pandemic and the trade wars totally exposed the fragility of that efficiency. When the borders closed and the ships literally stopped moving, governments suddenly realized that relying on a geopolitical rival for the components that power your military, your hospitals, and your telecommunications grid was a catastrophic vulnerability.
That realization just shattered the free market consensus. The analysis traces how governments across the US, Europe, and Asia began aggressively intervening in the market to steer capital towards strategic sectors.
They began picking winners.
They absolutely began picking winners.
We saw this with massive legislative packages. Trillions of dollars in tax credits, direct subsidies, and low-cost loans aimed at very specific industries.
The data highlights semiconductors and microchips, defense production, advanced energy systems, both renewable infrastructure and domestic fossil fuel independence, and broad technological dominance in areas like artificial intelligence and quantum computing.
The state essentially stepped in and said, we do not care if it is 30% more expensive to manufacture a microchip domestically. The national security imperative overrides the market efficiency.
So you end up with the US, China, and the European Union all engaging in this massive subsidy arms race to attract these strategic industries.
But here is where the analysis offers a truly profound insight. If everyone is offering subsidies, if the US is throwing billions at a semiconductor company and the EU is matching that offer, how does a company actually decide where to build? The capital is roughly equal.
The data suggests the deciding factor wasn't the size of the subsidy, but the degree of political continuity backing it up.
This brings us to the core thesis of the premium on predictability.
Yes. The analysis explores a really counterintuitive reality about corporate behavior. Businesses can actually adapt to highly restrictive environments.
They can.
Yeah. A company can operate successfully in a high-tax, high-regulation jurisdiction. They simply build the 30% tax rate and the stringent labor laws into their financial models. They adjust their pricing and they execute their strategy.
Because a high tax rate is a known variable. It's a heavy weight, sure, but you know exactly how much it weighs, so you can build a strong enough table to hold it.
Exactly. That is a brilliant way to put it. What breaks a corporate financial model is a variable that constantly fluctuates unpredictably.
Right.
A tax rate that swings wildly between 15% and 35%, depending on which political faction holds power, is far more damaging than a stable 30% rate. The analysis actually quantifies the extra costs of unpredictability.
So what do those extra costs look like on a balance sheet?
Well, we've touched on delayed investments, which cost you market share. But look at financing. When a corporation goes to the bond market to raise capital for a new facility, the interest rate they're charged is directly tied to the perceived risk of the environment they're operating in.
Oh, right.
If lenders fear that a sudden shift in trade policy or environmental regulation could strand the asset, they demand a higher yield. The risk premium increases.
So the money itself becomes more expensive to borrow.
Yes. Furthermore, the sheer administrative overhead of constant strategic reorientation, keeping armies of compliance officers, trade lawyers, and lobbyists on retainer, just to decipher the shifting landscape, it is a massive drain on capital.
It's friction. Every unpredictable rule change adds friction to the gears of the economy. And this realization had a profound impact on how the rest of the world viewed the United States during this window. Historically, the U.S. was the ultimate safe harbor. It was the deepest, most liquid, most legally predictable market on Earth.
But the volatility of the 2015 to 2029 period caused a global reassessment.
That's a huge shift.
It was. The data indicates that foreign investors and allied nations began to question American institutional stability. The commitment to international treaties, the continuity of trade policy, the reliability of the regulatory state, all of it was suddenly viewed with a degree of skepticism.
The sheer size of the American market still commanded massive investment, obviously, but the invisible capital had depreciated.
Which created an opening for competitors. And this leads to a fascinating contrast the analysis makes with Europe.
Wait, Europe? The poster child for red tape?
I know, right? Now, let's be clear. The data does not paint Europe as an economic utopia during this time. The continent faced severe structural challenges. Demographic decline, heavy bureaucratic fragmentation across the member states, really high energy costs, and generally slower GDP growth compared to the US or Asia.
Yet despite all those macroeconomic headwinds, the analysis reveals a shift in investor sentiment regarding specific regulatory spheres.
Yes. In certain sectors, European programs began to be perceived as significantly more predictable than their American equivalents.
I find this totally fascinating because the stereotype is always that European regulation is incredibly burdensome. Look at the digital sphere. The EU rolled out these massive, highly restrictive frameworks for data privacy, antitrust, and artificial intelligence. American tech executives routinely complained about the compliance nightmare.
It was a compliance burden, undoubtedly. But the key to the analysis is that once those massive European frameworks were negotiated and passed, they were locked in. The bureaucratic inertia of the EU, which makes it incredibly slow to act in the first place, also makes it incredibly hard to reverse course. A tech CEO looking at Europe knows exactly what the regulatory playing field will look like for the next decade.
Whereas in the US, during the same period, the regulatory approach to big tech or digital privacy was entirely dependent on executive orders, shifting agency mandates, and deadlocked congressional hearings. You might have one FTC chair threatening to break up your company, and 2 years later, a completely different administration just drops the lawsuits entirely.
The European contrast demonstrates that regulatory certainty, even when the regulations are stringent, carries immense economic value.
People just want to know the rules.
Exactly. The analysis highlights that in areas like climate policy, energy transition, and digital regulation, the EU established durable frameworks. They implemented carbon border adjustment mechanisms and long-term industrial strategies that foreign investors could bank on. Best practices and administrative predictability started to counterbalance the sheer gravitational pull of the American market size.
It's the tortoise and the hare, but applied to international capital flows. The hare is faster and way more dynamic, but it keeps running in zigzags and occasionally taking naps, while the tortoise just plots a straight, immovable line.
That's a great way to visualize it.
Let's pull all of these threads together, because we've covered a lot of ground. We've mapped out the structural debt, the psychological toll of inflation, the paralysis of polarization, the rewiring of global trade, and this desperate search for regulatory predictability. When we look at the final ledger for this 2015 to 2029 era, who actually won? Who successfully navigated this chaos and who absorbed the losses?
The analysis provides a very clear stratification of the winners and losers. In an environment characterized by structural unpredictability, heavy state intervention, and protectionism, the primary winners are domestic protected sectors.
The industries that managed to get behind the walls of the fortress.
Precisely. The defense industry is a clear beneficiary of heightened geopolitical tension and localized supply chain mandates. Strategic manufacturing sectors, like those semiconductor fabs that successfully secured those massive government subsidies, they gained enormous advantages.
Makes sense.
And certain domestic energy producers, particularly those shielded from foreign competition or favored by specific regulatory carve-outs, they also thrived.
So if the government deems your product essential to national security, or honestly, if you just have the lobbying power to secure a subsidy, you win. Who else is in the winner's circle?
The second major category of winners is found in the short-term financial markets. While long-term corporate planners despise unpredictability, speculative capital thrives on volatility.
They love the chaos.
They do. Hedge funds, high-frequency trading firms, and arbitragers make absolute fortunes off market dislocations. When a sudden tariff announcement tanks a specific sector or an unexpected subsidy causes a stock to surge, the entities designed to capitalize on short-term price swings extract massive amounts of wealth from the system.
Chaos is a ladder, provided you have the algorithms to trade it. But the list of losers is much broader, and frankly, it represents the foundational layers of a healthy economy.
The most direct losers are consumers. They ultimately pay the hidden taxes. They pay the import tariffs embedded in the price of electronics and vehicles. They suffer the erosion of purchasing power through inflation. Their baseline cost of living increases while the efficiency of the broader market decreases.
Then you have the export-focused businesses, the agricultural sector, for instance. A farmer growing soybeans for the global market doesn't benefit from a domestic microchip subsidy, but they absolutely get crushed when a foreign nation slaps a retaliatory tariff on American agriculture.
They become collateral damage in the trade wars.
Exactly.
The data also points to foreign investment as a casualty. Global capital is inherently cowardly. It flees uncertainty.
Right.
The erosion of the U.S.'s predictable, invisible capital meant that marginal investment dollars that might have flowed into building an American factory instead sought safer or at least more predictable jurisdictions.
But the loser that I find most concerning when we think about the long-term trajectory of the country is the innovation sector.
This is the crux of the problem. True. Paradigm-shifting innovation, whether it's commercializing fusion energy, developing next-generation biotechnology, or building out nationwide advanced infrastructure, it requires massive, highly concentrated upfront capital, and it requires a time horizon measured in decades.
You cannot execute a 20-year vision if your funding, your regulatory approval, and your supply chain access are subject to violent renegotiation every 2 years.
No, you can't.
The rule of premium becomes too high, the math stops working, and those ambitious projects are simply abandoned in the planning phase.
And that leads directly to the profound historical parallel the authors draw at the conclusion of their analysis. They zoom out from the specific 2015 to 2029 data set and look at the macro historical arc of global economic powers.
Looking at the really big picture.
Yeah. They observe that the longevity of an empire or a global hegemon is rarely determined solely by its military might or its geographic resources.
So what determines it?
Administrative stability. The analysis draws a line tracing the dominance of the Roman Empire, the British Empire, and the modern American economic system. The unifying characteristic of their peak periods wasn't just conquest, it was the establishment of a predictable system of exchange.
Wow, okay.
The Roman Empire codified laws, built durable infrastructure, and maintained a reliable currency. The British Empire underwrote global trade through the absolute reliability of the Bank of England, the sanctity of maritime contract law, and the predictability of its courts.
And the American century was built on the back of the dollar being the ultimate safe asset, backed by institutions that, despite their flaws, were fundamentally trusted by the global market. Which brings us to the single most important sentence in this entire dossier, the core thesis that ties everything we've talked about today together.
Trust is an economic factor of production.
Trust is an economic factor of production. I mean, we are taught that the factors of production are land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. You need raw materials, you need workers, you need money, and you need ideas.
That's the classic model.
But this analysis argues that trust is the invisible mortar holding all of those bricks together.
Without trust, land cannot be efficiently developed because property rights are uncertain. Labor becomes volatile because wages are eroded by unpredictable inflation. Capital retreats into defensive, short-term safe havens rather than funding long-term innovation. And entrepreneurship is stifled by regulatory whiplash.
It's all connected.
When trust declines, friction increases. Every single transaction, from a multinational merger to a local bakery securing a line of credit, becomes heavier, slower, and just more expensive.
So synthesizing everything from this deep dive into the 2015 to 2029 era, it's important to state clearly that the analysis does not conclude the American economy collapsed.
No, it certainly didn't.
The U.S. did not become a failed state. The sheer inertia, the deep capital markets, and the inherent entrepreneurial drive of the American system provided a massive buffer. The U.S. remained an absolute economic juggernaut.
Juggernauts are incredibly difficult to stop, but they're not immune to structural decay. The overarching conclusion of the data is that the political division and the resulting erosion of invisible capital prove that economic supremacy is not an inherent perpetual right.
It has to be maintained.
Yes. The American economy demonstrated remarkable resilience, but the foundation upon which that resilience was built showed profound stress fractures.
Which leaves us with the ultimate question posed by the analysis, a question that extends far beyond the year 2029. Can an economy maintain its global leadership when political instability shifts from being a cyclical occurrence to a structural reality?
The data suggests that the price of instability is not usually paid in a sudden dramatic crash. It is paid in a slow, compounding decay of potential.
The things that never happen.
Right. It is measured in the factories that were never built, the research that was never funded, and the international partnerships that were never signed because the risk premium was simply too high. Rebuilding trust takes generations. Destroying takes only a few cycles of sustained dysfunction.
It is the difference between a bad quarter and a changing climate. A market crash is weather. The structural loss of trust is climate change for the economy.
That's a very sobering way to look at it.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to pull all of this macro-level theory out of the boardrooms and central banks and bring it directly into your living room. We spent the last hour discussing how multi-billion-dollar corporations navigate unpredictability, but I want you to think about your own financial operating system.
Apply it to everyday life.
Exactly. Think about the fundamental assumptions you rely on when you make your biggest life choices. When you decide to invest in a college degree, when you calculate your retirement contributions, or when you sign a 30-year mortgage, you are operating on a deep, unspoken assumption that the fundamental rules of the economic game will remain relatively stable.
You have to, or you never make a move.
You trust the value of the currency, You trust the enforceability of your property rights, and you trust the durability of the institutions holding your assets. What happens to your personal ambition? Your willingness to take a risk, to start a business, to build a future, if you suddenly realize that the rule book we've all been playing by is actually written in pencil and the people holding the eraser are constantly fighting over it?
It changes the calculus of your entire life.
It really does. Understanding the mechanics of this invisible capital isn't just about understanding history. It is about understanding the invisible forces shaping your own financial future.
It provides a completely different lens through which to view every economic headline, every shift in trade policy, and every political debate over the debt. You stop looking at the noise, and you start looking at the structural integrity of the trust.
You really do. Now, if you thought the political and economic instability we examined today was intense, we have barely scratched the surface of institutional power.
Next time is going to be heavy.
It is. Next time on The Deep Dive, we are moving to Chapter 15 of the dossier. We are leaving the realm of the legislature and diving into the ultimate rulemakers, the Supreme Court. We will be exploring how the cementing of a long-term conservative majority impacts the deepest frameworks of American life, from the fundamental right to abortion, to the complex and highly contentious boundaries of presidential immunity, to the very scope of what the federal government is legally permitted to regulate.
It's a massive shift in jurisprudence.
We are going to examine how the long-term influence of judges appointed for life can vastly outlast any single presidency, altering the trajectory of the nation for generations. It is an exploration of the ultimate test of institutional trust, and it is going to be absolutely fascinating.
Yes, the perfect continuation. We move from the friction of making the rules to the absolute power of interpreting them.
Until then, keep an eye on the rules of the game and watch out for the shifting properties on your Monopoly board. Thanks for listening.